Hey, Libri Lounge listeners. Serge had to drop out partway through this episode, so that's just a heads up so you aren't wondering why suddenly it sounds like it switched to just me on the interviewer end. Anyway, we're really excited about this episode. Ludovic is a really great speaker and kind communicator, and it was a real treat having him on. Geeks is a really interesting topic, and yes, true to its name, we get pretty geeky in a good way in this episode, I think. Hope you enjoy.
Welcome to Libre Lounge, a podcast about free software, free culture, and all the other interesting aspects of user freedom, with Christopher Lemmer-Weber and Serge Roklowski.
Hey, Chris.
Hey, Serge.
So it's a rare opportunity that things we talk about in this show kind of come together. And we've had discussions about reproducible builds when we talked about some of the issues in NPM. We've talked about GNU and free software pretty much every episode. I think we've talked a little bit about Lisp. But here we have an opportunity as this week GNU Geeks hit 1.0. And we are lucky enough to be joined by Ludovic Cortez, the founder of Geeks. So, welcome.
Hello.
Welcome to the show, Ludo. It's very exciting to have you on.
Yeah, it's an honor to be here.
So, there's so much that we can unpack about GNU Geeks and why it's unique. I mean, I think everybody who does a podcast about Linux and GNU Linux talks about, distributions and package managers and all that. And I think we'll get to that. But I think the vitally important part about GNU Geeks is that it's not just another distribution, but it has some serious differences between itself and, let's say, the Debian project, or even Red Hat, or some of these others. So maybe we want to start with, from your perspective, what makes it distinct?
Right. So I guess, like you said, we talk a lot about package managers, and like we've known dozens of package managers in our lives. So why yet another one? That's what one might think. And I think we've been doing something different. So technically, it's a so-called functional package manager, but maybe that doesn't tell a lot to many people. What makes a difference to you as a user is that it's transactional, which means that you can install software, you can upgrade software, and if something goes wrong, you can always roll back. Mm-hmm. And to me, it really means a lot, to have the guarantee that if something goes wrong, then I can roll back. But then there are other technical differences, like I used this phrase in a talk of mine at FOSDEM. I said, you know what, Geeks is like the Emacs of distros, and Chris was saying, yeah, maybe you're right, but to many people it doesn't mean a lot. What does it mean to be the Emacs of distros? And I think Chris has a point. So what I wanted to say is that it's meant to be hackable. So it's written in Scheme, which is itself a dialect of Lisp. You can really inspect the whole distribution. You can see not only how packages are made, you can obviously rebuild them very easily. And you can also, navigate the whole distro just like you would do in any editor or IDE when you navigate code. And so you can see how everything is, glued together. And my hope is that the way this is structured, with just a single language and just a set of well-defined programming interfaces, my hope is that people can easily dive in, You don't have to dive in, but hopefully if you want to, you can see how things work together.
I think you've raised something important there with the transactional part, and I think to make it a little bit clearer for people who might not, let me try to unpack what I think you mean by that. A lot of our viewers or listeners are probably familiar with Git, and in many ways, Geeks and like Nix has the nice property that it kind of turns your entire operating system or package manager into kind of Git, being like Git in that if something goes bad, you can always just roll back in time. Would you say that's a pretty accurate way of phrasing that?
Right. Yes, exactly. Sure. And that's pretty unique. And it's also like Git in the sense that it's actually, I mean, the whole distro turns out to be in a single Git repo too. So yeah, there's a lot you can navigate the history. And of course, when you're using Git, you can also navigate the history of what you installed, what you upgraded, and you know, you can roll back and everything.
And there's something else that you said that I think is important from a cultural perspective, which is that for people on more proprietary operating systems, they may be used to just having, you know, being given their system, right? It comes out of the box and the new feature is whatever it is. And so everyone goes, oh, it's great, it's the new feature. Or maybe they hate the new feature, but that's what you get. And in the free software world, we're used to a very different approach where it's almost like you accumulate the system. As you know, as time goes on, you're like, well, I want this command to do this thing that's not standard, or I want this to look a certain way, and I want this to behave a way. And over time, the way your system behaves may not look anything or act anything like it did when you first got it, or a brand new system, or maybe your neighbor's same version of the same quote-unquote operating system. And what's interesting here is that this idea of hackability is interesting to me, because you're kind of taking that what is normally just user configuration and you're applying it to the entire system.
Right. Yeah, exactly. What's pretty unique, I mean, so maybe people know about NixOS, which is, you know, quite famous these days. And the pretty unique feature that NixOS brought back in the day, that you can basically describe your whole operating system configuration in a single file. So you can say, like, every, you know, file system partition, every user account, every service that you want to run, everything is declared in one file. And then you can instantiate that, which means, you know, install the system, deploy the operating system. And with Geeks, we're actually trying to take it a bit further, which is that, you know, your configuration file happens to be purely declarative, but it's also actual code, right? So as a user, you don't need to know that it's code. I mean, at least initially, I would say it really looks very declarative. It could pretty much be JSON or YAML if you want. But the thing is, it's actually code, so you can easily dive in, like follow, you know, you realize you're actually manipulating objects and functions in the scheme programming language. And so you can look up the APIs and see what else they offer. You can start, you know, fiddling with your configuration. You can write, let's say, functions that modify an operating system configuration to add such or such feature. And I think overall that makes it quite easy to navigate the whole thing and to, you know, customize it and to eventually also get to learn about the internals of the system.
So you touched on something interesting there, which is you mentioned that that, you know, that Geeks is very hackable by kind of treating, I'd say, you know, it Geeks kind of takes seriously the idea that your operating system in your package manager, you know, kind of is a program, right? And it seems to me that's the distinction between Geeks and Nix. And actually, we've gotten a number of people who have commented on this show before saying, Chris, you keep talking about Geeks and you haven't talked about Nix. And, you know, and I have some bias there because I've been involved in Geeks and not Nix. But I think I got involved in Geeks partly for the same reasons that you started Geeks. And I think maybe not everybody realizes, but you had history going back to the development of Nix, right? So what led, could you tell us a bit more about that story of the transition from your work on Nix to your work on Geeks?
Yeah. So, I mean, I was really amazed by the work by Elko Dolstra, you know, the founder of Nix, in his thesis, where he very well explained the problem with software deployment in general, and also came up with a solution which is based on functional programming, which is just, I mean, to me it was a revelation, so to speak. It was really something new, and I really advise you to read these papers. I mean, there's a couple of papers by Elko Dolster which are about, you know, the foundation of Nix, and it's really inspiring. And so, yeah, I started contributing to Nix, and I think I contributed for like maybe 4 years. And at the same time, I was also very much into Scheme and into GNU-Guile, which I was co-maintaining together with Andy Wingo and Mark River. And so somehow, you know, I felt like, you know, something needed to be done to sort of like join these two things. And I was also much frustrated about the use of, you know, a specific language in Nix. So yeah, maybe I need to explain a bit more. It turns out that Nix, so it's a package manager, but it uses its own language to define packages. It's a very, it's an interesting language, functional language, but it's, you know, it's very specific also. And it's very limited. It's a domain specific language, meaning that it's been designed specifically to write package definitions. And so when you want to do a bit more, you have to resort to an external language typically. So for example, if you look at the package definition in Nix, it's usually a mixture of the Nix language plus bash snippets and sometimes additional languages. And to me, that's a bit problematic, because that means that it's a bit harder to follow, because you have to know several languages. You have to understand how code is generated in a different language, for example. And it's also quite limiting if you want to design tools that work with packages, for example. So I think at the time I wrote a script that would automatically update package definitions in the Nix package collection. But to do that, I had to first convert, you know, the whole set of packages that's written in the Nix language, to convert that to XML, and then to parse that huge XML tree, and from there on to actually work on the XML tree. And well, long story short, it's pretty tedious to do and pretty inefficient. And I thought, well, why don't we do everything in the same language?
So, I mean, I think that there's a good argument to make that, I mean, Geeks has been picking up a lot of features very fast. Some of them that Nix didn't even have, such as, and I guess we could explain what it means. But for example, Mark Weaver's work on graphs to do faster security updates, and David Thompson's work on the like Geeks environment and the virtual machine tools and stuff like that. And I think that it's been my experience, and I think that you agree, Ludo, that that having packages just be a data type inside of the language means that the barrier to writing tools is actually very low. But is that a good summary of what you're saying in some ways, or
yes?
What do you think?
Yes, that's a very good summary. I was really pleased when people started writing these kind of tools, like what David did with Geeks Environment and with containers, and also what Alex Koss did with the Emacs interface. So yeah, I mean, like Alex designed a user interface that runs in Emacs using Geeks, so you can install packages in Emacs if that's your thing. But the important point here is that it was pretty easy to write that user interface, because if you write Scheme code, then Geeks and the whole package collection is just a Scheme library. And so you can navigate packages, and you can pretty easily write, you know, a new user interface on top of that. And to me, that was, yeah, like a sign that it actually works. I mean, that using a generic programming language actually allows people to write these kind of tools. And that's pretty cool, I think.
So that you just mentioned that, you know, the Emacs interface and kind of the command line tools that have been built and stuff like that. And this, And actually, I feel like that's a good chance to transition to Geeks 1.0 and some of the major features of it, because I think that you know, so one of my friends, Ava, made a joke to me that was Geeks is Gentoo for adults. And I actually, you know, I really enjoyed back in the day learning how to do what was called a stage one Gentoo install, where you know, kind of did all the steps manually by hand. And it was kind of a wave of nostalgia for me when I, you know, installed the Geeks USB stick and had to do all these commands manually. But I also kind of realized that that's not for everybody. So I believe that Geeks 1.0, one of its major features of this release is something addressing that. So do you want to speak to that?
Yeah, sure. So yeah, like you said, installing the standalone Geeks distribution on your laptop was pretty tedious until now. So like you had, like you said, you would boot into that USB key and then you had to type a number of commands, which is, you know, okay if you're familiar with GNU Linux, but still pretty tedious and obviously not for everyone. So one of the big news in that space in 1.0 is the installer. So we have a text mode graphical installer. So basically, if you've ever installed Debian, for example, you have, you know, all these dialog boxes that allow you to install the whole system. And pretty similar spirits, except that at the end, the installer generates a configuration file, which is the declaration of your whole operating system configuration. So the end result of that installer is the configuration of your system as a single file, which is pretty cool. So as a user who is not familiar with Geeks, I think it's quite easy to install it thanks to this installer. And at the end, you get to see what it's like to declare the whole operating system configuration. So that's pretty cool. And we owe it to Mathieu Otache. I'm not sure if I pronounced the name right, but that's really, really an amazing piece of work that Mathieu has been doing here.
Yeah, so I think this, it's also a good opportunity to discuss why Scheme, like why not, for example, and, you know, maybe Python isn't that functional, but, you know, if we, you know, some sort of language, you know, that maybe is more popular syntactically, like Python, I think that the installer, you gave a bit of a hint there as in terms of what the kind of thing that like Scheme is really good for, in that writing out the file thing. Could you expand on that? Like, why might we choose a Lispy language over something that's kind of a bit more conventionally accepted syntactically?
Yeah. So I guess one of the main reasons initially that I was very much into Scheme, so that's like an emotional or a subjective reason probably. But technically, I think there are also very good reasons to choose Scheme, to choose a Lisp in general for that kind of stuff. So Lisp is often described as a programmable programming language, meaning that it's not a fixed set of language constructs. It's not a fixed set of features. You can always extend it with new programming language constructs and things like that. So what it means is that if you compare to a more traditional programming language like Python or C maybe, where you have, you know, a very fixed syntax which cannot be extended or hardly be extended, I would say, well, usually you would have to resort to additional programming languages to do domain specific things. And that's the reason, for example, why Nix itself is written in C++. But the Nix language is a different language because it would be too hard in C++, I guess, to define, you know, packages, for example. In Scheme, you can just define new constructs. So, for example, we have some sort of a language, a domain-specific language to define packages. We also have, maybe language is too strong of a word, but you know, syntactic constructs which are lightweight, which are similar to what you would write in JSON or in a declarative way, that allow you to define packages and operating system configurations. And so you get sort of the both of both worlds, the best of both worlds, which means that you have a very high level declarative way to represent packages, yet it's an actual scheme object. So we've been able to basically extend not just the APIs that we provide, but really the some of the syntax of the language.
It also means that doing something like having the installer write out the config as scheme code is not too difficult because Lisp is kind of optimized for that, in that like the language itself, you're kind of looking at its data structure. So generating scheme code to write out to a configuration file is actually code that writes code is pretty trivial in a Lisp.
Right, exactly. And code generation actually happens quite a lot in Geeks because, for example, we use Scheme not just to define packages, but also to write all the plumbing to build the package. So, for example, if you have a package, probably you're going to build it using maybe configure make install or Python setup.py, that kind of stuff. And all this plumbing is also written in Scheme, which means that at some point we have, a bit of Scheme that's used by your command line interface and that define packages, but it's also generating more Scheme code that will actually run when you build the package. And that pattern, happens in different places in Geeks. Like, for example, we're also using the init system, PID1, the first program that starts when the operating system boots. It's also written in Scheme. And so it's configured again in Scheme. So that means we have to generate those Scheme files that configure like system services, for example. Like you said, Scheme and Lisp lends itself very well to this kind of operation.
What's the difference between Geeks as a package manager versus Geeks as a distribution?
What's the difference? Well, we tend to describe Geeks as a package manager because I guess that was the initial application, so to speak. But nowadays it's more than that. It's really a toolbox, I would say, for software deployment in general. So everything that has to do with, deploying a single package or a complete software environment or an operating system, that's what Geeks does. And so it's all pretty much entangled. So you can use Geeks as a package manager, plain like apt, how would you pronounce it? Apt-get, I guess, on top of your distribution, and that's fine. That's what many people do. But you can also install Geeks as a standalone distribution, like you would install Debian on your machine. And so if you use Geeks as a standalone distribution, then that's when you get that declarative configuration mechanism. So at that point, you basically declare your complete operating system configuration in one file, and then you have a command that is called geek system that basically can consume that operating system configuration and then reconfigure your machine to actually run that operating system. But the really nice thing is that you can also say, all right, I have my operating system configuration file, but I want to generate a virtual machine, for example, and to test my configuration in a virtual machine. And then you can do geek system VM. That's going to produce a virtual machine that runs your operating system. So that's pretty convenient, like when you want to test new changes, like you want to add a new system service and you want to see what it's like if it's working as expected. Well, that's what it's for. You can just do geek system VM and you get a virtual machine running that configuration. And so that's really, so to answer your question, the distribution is really going a step further. So you have the package manager, that's one thing, and then you have the distribution, which is the next level. And I should say that in between, you have also Geeks environment, which we mentioned before, which is sort of a middle ground in a way because it's about managing software environments, so typically a set of packages. And on top of that, we also have additional tools. So like you can So I mentioned virtual machines, but you can also create a Docker image that contains your operating system. And you can also create a Docker image containing just a set of packages with Geekspack. Roughly everything that has to do with software deployment can be handled by this single toolset. And I think that's quite unique. You know, we're used to having different tools for each one of these categories. Like you have one tool to provision containers, you have one tool to provision virtual machines, different tools for each of these technologies. And here we have a single toolset that knows about software packages and that's able to actually make all these different artifacts. That's pretty useful, I think, pretty convenient.
To expand on what the functional system means, it seems like, you know, if you've got, let's say package foo depends on, you know, if packages bar and baz and those change, it's going to make a new version of foo, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So how does that lead into, I know you've been doing work on both reproducible builds, or the Geeks team has been doing work on reproducible builds, and there's also work on bootstrapability. And maybe you want to expand on what those mean?
Yeah. So there's a reproducible builds effort, actually, that's on reproducible-builds.org that's led mostly by Debian developers who initiated the effort. So what's a reproducible build? Well, a reproducible build is a build that allows you to make sure that the binary artifacts that you're getting, that you're actually running on your system, actually correspond to some specific source code. And it sounds trivial, but you know, most of the time, if you receive a binary, like if you download a Java archive from the internet, or if you install a package with your, you know, package manager on your distro, then you're getting a big binary, and it's pretty hard to tell that the binary really corresponds to the source code that it's supposed to correspond to. So it's really, initially, it's really a security issue, which is that if I install, let's say, Debian packages on my machine, how can I tell that I'm actually running the software that I wanted to install in the first place? How can I tell that it doesn't have any backdoors?
Well, Debian, and actually we should throw in, Debian is, the Geeks community is collaborating with Debian on that front though, right?
Right, yeah. And with other distros as well. But Debian has really been leading the way on that effort. And so the thing is, we need to be able to verify that the binary that we get as users actually correspond to some specific source code, you know? If we are not able to verify that, then there's no security because, you know, you could be running any piece of software. It could contain backdoors. And it's also a problem for user freedom. I mean, as a user, I'm supposed to have the freedom to study and modify the software. But if I'm not even sure that the software that I'm running really corresponds to the source I have at hand, then that's a serious issue. And so that's what people are trying to address in the reproducible build effort.
Right.
Now, yeah, now I think Nix and Geeks are in a very special situation in that effort. So this is all, I mean, we're standing on the shoulders of giants and of Nix in particular here, because Nix pioneered the so-called functional package deployment model. And that's very, very unique. I mean, it's designed with reproducibility in mind, so to speak. And what does that mean? Well, I mean, if you look at how Nix and Geeks build packages, it's pretty different from what's being done by other distros. So typically in Nix and Geeks, when you're starting a package build, it's setting up an isolated environment for the build itself, and that environment contains only the dependencies of the package and nothing else. That means that if you, Chris, for example, build some package, Inkscape, on your laptop, and I build the very same thing on my laptop, because they are isolated, then we're going to have probably the same result. Now, I say probably because there can be, you know, sources of non-determinism, like something in the package build process could lead to different outputs in spite of that isolated environment. But in general, that's a very good way to get the assurance that you're going to have reproducible builds by default, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. So if we can really, it's kind of saying if we can play back, what we want to build and all the things we want to build it with, we can really get very precisely knowledge that we get the same thing out on the other side. And that can help us escape some of the, you know, kind of dangers of somebody, you know, saying, oh, hey, look, you know, here's this binary. And then, you know, and you're like, oh, okay, this is probably the right thing. And then, but somebody might have injected something malicious in it. Right.
Right.
But there's one more, but you know, so it's, you can kind of go all the way down with this. Right. And if we get all the way down to the bottom, of that, you know, making sure that, you know, Django is built with, reproducibility, and then, Python's built reproducibly, and then, you know, glibc is built reproducibly, except wait a minute, there's some sort of point at which we have to use something to build up the rest of the system. And that's where the bootstrapping conversation comes in, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, so reproducible builds is all about making sure that when you actually build something, you get, you know, reproducible build results, reproducible binaries. But like you're saying, the elephant, there's an elephant in the room, which is that at some point, usually there's a big binary blob because you need to start from somewhere. And so Gix was no exception. I mean, if you looked at the dependency graph of all the packages, you took the compiler GCC, and then it depended on glibc, which itself depended on a different variant of GCC. And at some point, everything was depending on pre-compiled versions of GCC, glibc, binutils, and so on and so forth. And That's a problem, I think. That's a problem because it means we have this big set of binaries at the root of our dependency graph. And it's pretty much impossible to audit these binaries. I mean, we're talking about 500 megabytes, something like that. And so that's very big. So the good thing with Gix is that at least we have a very clear dependency graph. We could see in the dependency graph all these big binaries, whereas on traditional distros it's a bit more fuzzy. Like, it's pretty hard to tell what the set of bootstrap binaries is.
So this is where the MACE project comes in, right?
Exactly. So Janneke and a bunch of other hackers have done an amazing job. So when we started Gix, actually Gix had a section in the documentation describing what I just described. So saying, you know what, this is all depending on a big set of binaries, but now you know, now you know that this is how it is made. But we know it's not great because it's not source code, right? It's just binaries. And so we'd like to do something. And Janneke was inspired and actually started working on this. And it's a pretty hard issue because we're talking about building a C compiler. So the problem that Janneke set to solve was, how do we build that initial GCC and glibc with something that is smaller? And that's pretty tough, you know? So when Janneke started working on it, that was, I don't know, 2 years ago, I would say.
Yeah, we think like, about that.
Yeah, I was like, this is awesome, but it's really going to be hard. I was like, yeah, it's great that you're tackling this problem, but we know that we didn't even know how exactly that could happen. Janneke,
well, let's describe the actual problem that's trying to be solved, right? There, we've mentioned it before on the show, but there's something called the Thompson attack, which is basically you could put a evil thing inside of your compiler that says, the next time I build a compiler, I'm going to put an evil thing inside of it, even if the compiler's source code doesn't have that, right? So like, it's basically you inject this evil thing that you then never know kind of continues to exist there into the future. Is that a good basic summary of that?
Yeah, right. I should have started by explaining this. But yeah, the Thompson attack is really, that's a whole issue. So yeah, like you're saying, in those 500 megabytes, we have GCC. And what if that GCC actually has a backdoor built in and is able to propagate that backdoor in the binaries that it produces? And that's a Thompson attack. It means that, you know, that backdoored compiler could propagate the backdoor again and again, and we'd be unable to notice. That's pretty big deal.
So if I want to see if I remember how Mace tries to solve this problem, is basically you have a scheme program that can build a small, that can run a very small C compiler, and a very small C compiler that can build a scheme program, a scheme interpreter. And basically by having both of those, you can kind of have one build the other and be sure that they're able to build each other and escape that problem. Is that an accurate portrayal, or am I missing something?
Something like that. So I'm not completely up to date with the latest changes, but so MES, actually MES, stands for Maxwell Equations of Software, and it's a scheme interpreter. And there's a MES-CC on top of it, which is a C compiler, like you said, which is able to compile a tiny CC, which is a slightly bigger and more featureful C compiler. And roughly at some point, I forgot the details, but at some point we are able to compile an actual GCC until we reach a modern GCC, including G++.
Right. It starts by compiling tiny CC first, I think, which then itself can compile an older GCC, which can compile a newer GCC, and then we can get pretty much the whole system.
Right, exactly. So this is actually no longer fiction. It sounds like sci-fi, but it's becoming a reality. So Janneke pushed the work in a branch in Gix. Which means that, so you're not getting that work if you use Gix 1.0, but soonish, I don't know, maybe a couple of months from now, we'll be merging this in master, meaning that thanks to the work that has been done, instead of having this 500 megabyte binary seed, as they call it, we will have a reduced binary seed, which is like half of it. And that's already, you know, a significant improvement. And I think, you know, bootstrapping is not black and white. It's pretty much like you have to reduce as much as possible your initial binary seeds, you know, those big OPEG binaries. And that's already great progress. Now, the thing is that the same problems happens every time you have a compiler, basically, not just for the initial C compiler. So, for example, we have a Rust compiler, and Rust is itself written in Rust. So the normal way to build Rust is by using the previous version of Rust. And you can see the problem. You have to have a whole chain of Rust versions if you want to be able to build from source. But even if you do that, it turns out that the oldest version of Rust that we have is not, I don't know, it's not, people have investigated and we are not able to rebuild it the way it was done back then. So fortunately, Danny, a Gix contributor, managed to build an old Rust using an alternate implementation of Rust that's in C++. So that's just to say that it's another instance of the bootstrapping problem that's being addressed. And we have to do this, you know, for Haskell as well. We have to do this for OCaml. You know, there are lots of instances, but the bootstrappable.org website is very much about raising awareness about the issue. I mean, the Thompson attack is a 40-year-old problem, I think. And like you explained, it's pretty big deal. I mean, if you have that backdoor that propagates, that's a serious issue. And only now are people, and when I say people, it's really a group of brave hackers. Only now are they starting to address this, and I'm really grateful that people like Janneke are working on this because that's really big deal. It's crazy that software people have forgotten about this problem somehow.
Awesome. So I guess now this might be a good time to transition to what do you think the future of the project is for Geeks?
So we've been accumulating lots of ideas of things we wanted to do, and yeah, there are many areas where we want to make progress. So one of them, for example, is software distribution. How do we distribute those binaries? So currently, we have a build farm that's used to distribute binaries to everyone, and we've offered as an option the ability to download from a content distribution network, a CDN. Which is, it's not all that satisfactory. I mean, it's great in terms of performance and reliability, I guess. That's why we have this option, but it's not so great. And we'd like instead to have the option to distribute software in a peer-to-peer fashion. So in the past, we investigated a bit GNUnet. There was a Google Summer of Code project. And more recently, we started looking at IPFS, which is a peer-to-peer storage mechanism. And we discussed with the IPFS developers, and it seems to be a pretty good fit to distribute binaries. So my hope is that soon enough, that's one of the thing we'll be working on. Soon enough, hopefully, we'll be able to distribute binaries over IPFS, which should be.
What about source? Do you think source will also be distributed over that form?
Right, yeah, probably because, well, I mean, source and binaries are pretty much the same thing to geeks. They're just
Right.
so it doesn't really.
Well, sort of, right? But I mean the real risk is if we want geeks to be able to be this kind of archive of software for a long time, then if one of the sites go, that's kind of the evil hidden secret in Geeks right now is that if like the source disappears from this site, then like there's no real way to get it back again. But if we have a more content address system, then the entire network can help keep things alive, right?
Oh right, yeah. That's yeah, like you say, source has to be available somehow. And I guess yeah, IPFS could help, but maybe it's not the ultimate solution to this problem because IPFS would probably store only popular content. So maybe source code would eventually vanish anyway. But we've been working on this particular problem with Software Heritage. I don't know if you've heard about that initiative before, but they're
I have, but our audience might
All
not.
right. So Software Heritage is about building a huge archive of source code. So basically taking everything from source code hosting sites and just archiving it forever, so to speak. And that's exactly what we need for geeks. We need to have a stable archive where we can always, get all source code possibly. And to me, that looks like the right solution, to have a non-profit taking care of ensuring that source code is archived. It's pretty much like the Internet Archive, but for source code. And we already have support to fetch source code from Software Heritage, which means that normally, if everything goes well, and if the upstream website vanishes, then we are able to get source code from Software Heritage. And that's pretty cool. So there are still some challenges to address. Like, for example, currently Software Heritage doesn't have precisely all the source code archive or all the commits that it refers to. So we're working with them to see how we could eventually ensure that they have precisely what we need. But that sounds very promising. That's again one of these post 1.0 tasks that I think we'll be working on in the coming month.
Okay. Awesome. And I guess there's a lot of opportunities in geeks. I mean, one of the things that I'm still interested in, and I feel like we haven't, and I think that there's a good chance that we'll be seeing more headway in the next over the course of the next year. But I'd really like to see more on server deployment, for instance, of geeks. I guess there. We'll see what happens over the next few months. But I don't know. Do you have any thought? Is there anything else you want to talk about it for the future, or for how people can get involved in geeks development?
So, well, for the future, just to mention a few things. So like you're saying, there's distributed deployment. We'd like to be able to say, look, this is a declaration of my operating system, and I want to deploy it on a bunch of machines, you know, possibly with variants. And that's something that's hopefully going to happen. I mean, I hope we'll be able to work on it. There's a perhaps with Google Summer of Code, we'll be able to start working on it. That would be really great. And there are all other things we'd like to look at. Like, we've actually, when you know, working on gigs, we've started fiddling with the operating system lower layers, so to speak. And there's a natural next step would be to start fiddling with the GNU herd, because you know the GNU herd is actually something. It's an actual operating system. People don't realize, they think it's just vaporware, and that's. I mean. That's also true in a way, I guess, but it's also an actual POSIX operating system that you can do things with, and it's very flexible. It gives users a lot of freedom. So it's very much in the same spirit as Gix, in that it's about giving users more freedom and more facilities. And so probably there will be something with Gix on GNU herd, I hope so.
Yeah, I hope so as well. I think that, as you said, a lot of people think it's vaporware, but I think you and I have both run herd at least in a testing environment at one point, and both been inspired by the project. So it does. It is a thing that boots and runs, but I think very few, if anybody, is using it from their day to day. But it could be really exciting. The ideas behind it are really powerful, and I think right now we're seeing a real resurgence of interest in microkernels, especially, the interest in L4 and even Google is interested in rolling out microkernels, partly, I think, because of how bad security is on monolithic kernels and kind of the classic Unix system. And I actually think that if we don't get a real community-oriented approach to microkernels, we could be in a bad spot, personally.
Yeah.
But anyway, I think that could be really exciting. So why don't we talk about getting involved in doing development? So you mentioned that it's a project that intends for people to be able to pick up and hack. And how much Scheme does somebody have to know to contribute a Geeks package?
It can be very little, I think. So, I mean, people who started contributing, so most contributors initially write package definitions, right? The package, it's not there, so you end up writing the package definition. That's less usual today because there are almost 10,000 packages, but still, I mean, you know, sometimes you don't find the package that you need. And so to write package definitions, you really don't need to know much Scheme. I mean, it's really, it could be XML or JSON. That's pretty cool. But then obviously when you start writing more complex package definitions or, you know, for complex pieces of software, then you start doing a little bit of Scheme. And I think like if you look at most contributors initially, they probably didn't know Scheme at all, I would say, most of them. But then you get into it and you start using, you know, that function and another thing and the module and stuff, and you get to learn about Scheme. So it can be pretty incremental.
That's been my experience as well. I mean, I started developing on, I'd actually wanted to contribute packages to distributions for a long time. And it's partly because doing a Git checkout of Geeks and, I wouldn't say it was so easy. It was actually much dramatically easier than I expected. And I had never successfully gotten in a package before to any other distribution. And I think what personally One of the things I really like about the Geeks community is how friendly it is to people who want to contribute. So I appreciate the work that you, Ricardo, and others have done to try to keep the community a really friendly place.
Yeah. I mean, we're trying to do our best here. We have a code of conduct. We want to make sure that it's a good experience for anyone joining. That's the whole story. It should be a good experience. Otherwise, it's not worth it. That's my opinion.
Yep. I agree. All right. Well, I think we're getting towards the point where we're going to wrap up. So is there anything else you want to chat about before, or any shout outs you want to give or anything before we wrap up?
Yeah, I mean, speaking of contributing, so we discussed technical contributions and, you know, there are packages, there are system services that one might want to contribute or core things, but there are also many, you know, non-technical or less technical contributions that one can make. It could be translations, it could be artwork, websites, you know, taking care of the infrastructure. There are lots of things that people have been doing during all these years, so if you want to join and you have skills in one specific area, I'm sure there are tasks for you.
Sounds great. All right. Well, at that point, I think that we're going to wrap up. So thanks, Ludo, for joining us on the show. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
And if you wanted to, you know, communicate with us, we are on Pound Libre Lounge on Freenode. We are at Libre Lounge on floss.social, and we're, if you want to go to the bird site, we're at Libre Lounge on Twitter, and you can also reach out to us at I think it's show@librelounge.org, and otherwise also we'll see you all next time. All right, take care.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
You've been listening to Libre Lounge. You can find and subscribe to us at LibreLounge.org. This podcast is released under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 4.0 International License. Our theme music is Bossa Nova by Joth, which is waived into the public domain under CC0 and which you can find on OpenGameArt.org. If you'd like to support Chris Weber's work on this and other user freedom projects, you can donate at patreon.com/CWEBBER. Thanks for listening. See you next time.